Hey guys, I'm an addict. My name is Phil Hassman.
Yeah, Phil.
I feel really fortunate to be here today. I didn't get to the Friends of Jimmy Kay on a winning streak. I got referred to a treatment center because I was making a pretty big mess of my life. And my family decided that they had seen enough of me being in charge, and they gave me an invitation. They invited me to go get some help, and they followed that up with a bit of a threat. They said that if I didn't accept their offer for help, that I was free to continue living my life the way I wanted to without them in it. And I knew enough at that time that I didn't want that outcome, so I was actually quite... I really welcomed the invitation to get away. If you want to know the truth, they got me at just the right time. I was out of answers, man. Yeah, well, almost. That happened later. I was on this routine where I was trying to keep a party going with people that I didn't even like or know. It was costing me more than I was making, and I didn't know how to get off, man. And so when my family showed up and they pleaded with me, they cried, they begged me to please go get help. I was glad to have a way out, man. And I went to a treatment place and I was there 30 days. And you've probably heard the story. I got well. I got well in 30 days. I came back home to the same home that I left. I was living alone, as we like to say, with a maniac, right? And I had some physician-prescribed narcotics that I thought were perfectly appropriate for the circumstance. When I finished taking as much of those as often as I wanted to, and I ran out of them, I found a bottle of brandy, and that started me off on another run. Well, I was already on the run, as you guys know, but it clearly delineated for the people that were watching around me that there was a departure from sobriety, because they couldn't smell the pills on my breath, right? So the gig was up, and I was no longer welcome in the family, and I tried to tell myself that I was okay with that for a while, and eventually I just couldn't take it anymore, So I got into some outpatient stuff, and for the next year and a half, I would go to meetings out of self-defense. I would go to meetings because those were conditions for me to be a part of my family and to sleep in the big bed with the girlfriend. If I didn't do those things weren't happening. So I went to the meetings, and I met several of you that are here in the room today. And I'll never forget the first time I went to the Friends of Jimmy Kay meeting. I went to the Friends of Jimmy Kay meeting because it was a men's meeting in Tulare, and I was convinced that since I grew up in Tulare, I probably knew Jimmy Kay. And couldn't remember from the high school yearbook which one was Jimmy Kay, but I got there and I ran into Mike. We called him Wheelchair Mike, and I ran into Jesus. And at my first meeting of the Friends of Jimmy Kay, these two guys brought a level of honesty that I didn't know how to process. It got my attention. It still has my attention. I'm supposed to tell you a little bit about what happened with me, and I've started that, but I do want to be careful. Look, guys, I'm frequently wrong. If you know me and you're around me very often, you know that. You're well acquainted with that idea. I'm frequently wrong. I suffer from self-delusion, and has been pointed out to me on many occasions, the biggest problem with self-delusion is the dummy that has it doesn't know it. Right? So I run around convinced that I know what I'm talking about when I'm wrong. And one of the questions that I'm frequently asked is, what are you wrong about now? And the problem with that is, I don't know. And I think that's one reason why it's so critically important that I hang around with people like you, people that are seeking the truth, people that will sometimes in brutality it feels, acquaint me with the truth, even when I don't always want to hear it. It's always proven to be better for me, even if it does hurt my feelings. So there's guys like Poncho over here that demonstrate for me behavior that I want to emulate. And one of the things that Poncho does all the time is he goes to the literature. And I believe the truth is in the literature, and I believe as long as I stay close to it, then I'm probably going to be in as good a shape as I can get myself into. So I took a look through the basic text and the essays on steps 8 and 9. It's all fantastic material, but there were a couple of things that I read in there that really jumped out to me, seemed to kind of hit me with those daggers we heard about. These are things I want to share with you that I hope I'll do a good job of including in the stories I'm going to tell you about steps 8 and 9. So if you bear with me for a moment, I want to do that. But before I read that, I do want to start with one other thing, and that is just a quick prayer. Because one of the things that I really did not know how to do when I got here was to have a relationship with a higher power. I just didn't know how to do that, man. And you guys have shown me it's really pretty simple. So I'm going to do that. I hope you will welcome this. But Creator, I just thank you for another clean day here on earth. I thank you for all the blessings that you've put in our lives. I pray that you would help us to see them, to share them, and to be good stewards with them. Pray that you would help us all to be the men that you'd have us be. I pray that you'd show us your will for us and give us the willingness and the strength to carry it out. Pray that all of your children would come to know you, that they would find the joy and the peace and the love and the freedom and the hope that you offer. Pray, Lord, that pray that you'd give me the strength to help other people, especially when I don't want to. And for all those who are suffering, I pray for their comfort in you. It's in your name I pray. Amen. Okay, so off to the literature. It says in the eighth step we heard earlier, we made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. The eighth step is not easy. It demands a new kind of honesty about our relations with other people. The eighth step starts the process of forgiveness. We forgive others, possibly we are forgiven, and finally we forgive ourselves and learn how to live in the world. It seems hard now, but once we have done it, we will wonder why we did not do it long ago. It will not make us better people to judge the faults of another. We hurt others directly or indirectly through some action, lie, broken promise, or neglect. Our futures are changed because we don't have to avoid those who we've harmed. As a result of this step, we receive a new freedom that can end isolation. As we realize our need to be forgiven, we tend to be more forgiving. So those are all from the step 8 essay. And then into step 9, it tells us that this step should not be avoided. If we do, we are reserving a place in our program for relapse. It says timing is an essential part of this step. We want to be free of our guilt, but we don't wish to do so at the expense of anyone else. In the process of our recovery, we are restored to sanity, and part of sanity is effectively relating to others. We less often view people as a threat to our security. So I want to tell you about three relationships. One is with my father. And many of you that know me have heard a lot of this story. I hope to add a new chapter to the story. When I was at the treatment center, we did some different kinds of treatment modalities, and one of the things that they did brought back some memories that I had been repressing for a very long time. And the memories that they brought back were of violence between my father and I when I was a young child. And so when I came back home, I brought with me this memory and this anger and this rage for my father. And I didn't know what to do with it. The only thing I could figure out to do with that anger was to avoid him entirely, to force him entirely out of my life. And you know, that's easy to do on a Tuesday and a Wednesday, but when it's like his birthday or Thanksgiving or Christmas, it becomes a little bit bigger piece of business to purposely omit a family member like your parents from your life. And I was just so afraid of him and what he might do, what I might say, what I might do. I was afraid. I was just afraid. And so I thought the best thing for me to do was stay away from him, and I did that for about a year and a half. And in that period of time, I got to know some of you, and I'll never forget. I should say also, because this is important, I also sought the help of a mental health care professional, and I got some therapy from someone who helped me to navigate this this dilemma, right? Because look, I would have told you that I don't need my dad in my life. I don't really want him in my life, and I sure as hell don't need his affection or his love or his approval. And there was just something that told me that I was maybe not right about all that. So I talked to this therapist about it, and she gave me some ideas. And she said, well, maybe you could begin to restore this relationship with your father, if that's what you want to do, by doing something safe. And I thought, okay, how about like maybe lunch? Right, so I scheduled a lunch with my father, and because it's in a public place, it's got a start and end time, and I had my own car, and it just I felt like I could probably do that, and so I scheduled this lunch with my dad. We had lunch, and it was really, really awkward, man. It was really awkward, and I got through it, and I'm not going to say I really felt better after that. I'm not going to tell you that because I don't know that I really did, right? But I didn't feel worse. And what happened was I did it again, maybe like a month later. And then maybe 6 weeks later I did it again, and then maybe three or four or five or 6 weeks later I did it again. And in the process of that, I began to feel a little bit less threatened by my father. And my dad one time actually invited me to go to a football game. And it was a Fresno State football game. And the last time I'd been to the Fresno State football game, I was smoking meth in the men's bathroom and drinking myself crazy. And it's still a mirror. I don't know how it is. I didn't get caught up. I was in line for the DUI checkpoint, and somehow they turned the damn thing down like two cars ahead of me, and I didn't get busted. Right, just stupid luck, right? And so my dad invites me to this game, and I'm thinking, I don't, that's not safe, man. I can't do that. And so I come to Jimmy K, and I tell that story, and Larry. Larry says, hey man, you know what? I didn't get the opportunity to have a relationship with my dad because he was gone before I got clean. And he said, I don't know how to tell you this in any stronger terms, but I encourage you to not miss this opportunity. And Michael over there, when I said, yeah, Larry, good looking out. Yeah, you know, maybe next time I'll say yes. And Michael chimed in with, yeah, why don't you buy the tickets next time? Asshole. But, hey, but you know what? You know what? I don't know why, but But I did. And it was a very good experience. And my dad and I continued to have these lunches, and I'd have to call him and tell him when we were going to meet and all that. And I mentioned to Bobby how weird these conversations were, and he asked me, you know, so, you know, how are you ending those conversations? And I'm like, see you at lunch, Dad, you know? And he goes, is that the way you're supposed to end those kinds of conversations? And I knew it. Dude, I knew. I mean, he was setting me up, right? And he encouraged me to do what I knew was the right thing. And so the next time I got on the phone with my dad, I said, okay, I'll see you at the burger place, whatever. Love you. And I caught him off guard, man. He hadn't heard nothing like that from me for a long time, for a couple of years at least. And he didn't know what to do, and the phone line went dead, and that was that. And I thought, yes, I won. And I went back to Spons, and I said, hey, man, check it out. I won. I'm victorious. I don't have to do that again. And he says, yeah, you know, we don't stop doing the right thing because we don't get the results we're looking for. So now I'm looped into doing this again. And I do it again, and then the second time, you know, and Dad says, I love you too. And then this goes on for a while. And meanwhile, remember, I told you, I don't need my dad in my life. I don't want him in my life. I don't care about him, his affections, approval, and I certainly don't need his love. And then there's that time when we're having this phone call, and he says it first. And it just floored me. And I found out that I was wrong. I was wrong, man. I don't know why those relationships are so important to us, but they are. My dad and I have continued to have those lunches until his living situation changed, and I don't see him as often anymore, but what I've replaced that with is phone calls several times a week. And they always end with, I love you. And sometimes he still says it first. And sometimes my dad irritates me. I'm sure I irritate him too. A couple of years ago, my dad offered to let me use his motorcycle to take my wife for a ride on a nice spring day, and we took it and we had a great time. And my dad hadn't really been riding the bike in years, and I offered to buy it from him, and he says, you know what, son, I'm going to give this to you, but I still want to hold on to my, I'm gonna ride it still, right? And so time goes by and times go by, and I say, hey, Dad, can I borrow the bike? And it feels like he's coming up with one excuse after another for why I can't borrow the bike. I know how to protect myself in this case. I stop asking. And I start telling anybody that might have a hint that there's anything going on there that this doesn't concern me anymore, that I give up any claim to the bike, it's done. And I suppose very secretly I carry around this little resentment that, you know, my dad's toy, holding this carrot out, you know, to like get me to do something. And I'm not biting. I'm not playing. I'm not going to do whatever it is. But I just keep doing what I do. And you know, like I said, we evolve into this call situation several times a week. And in October, he called me and he said, I'm ready. The bike's yours. He brought it to me. I mean, I didn't even have to go get it. But before he did that, he said something that hurt my feelings. He goes, okay, I'm ready to give you the bike, but you can't drink when you're riding it. I got like 14 years clean and sober, man. What are you talking about? And see, again, I'm the last person to see some of these things, right? See, because what I didn't tell you about this story is that the last time I had a motorcycle, I crashed it, loaded out of my mind on the motorcycle, and earned the nickname Kill Bill, right? And so, you know, I can't see this, but the truth of the matter is, the reason my dad won't give me his bike is because he doesn't want to be the one that everybody's blaming for me killing myself on it. Oh, dang. But I can't see it, man. I got that if you care, I got that from a panel of inmates at Corcoran State Prison. I was telling them my woes about how my stingy dad won't give me the bike, and and they'll switch problems with any one of us on any day of the week. So that's Dad, and that's the latest chapter. I've had the bike now for a couple of months. I've really enjoyed riding it out to Corcoran. I want to take it in to show the inmates. You know, they won't let me do that. So there's another relationship I want to tell you about, and that is with a very close, good, dear friend. In fact, such a close friend, he ended up marrying my sister. And then their marriage didn't work out. But I maintained a friendship with him, and kind of on the down low, you know, I went out, this was back in 1998, I went back out to Lake Havasu to go water skiing with him, and we were having a grand old time, man. We were just loaded out of our minds, and we both decided it would be a really good idea to try water skiing in a 2-foot swell on the afternoon after we'd been, you know, getting so toasted. And while he was in the water, he did a little better than I did on the skis, and I was a little bit jealous, and I thought it would be funny to throw a wake of water at him. And as many of you have heard the story know, I ended up putting the propeller through him. three very serious lacerations, the most significant of which showed his hip bone protruding and freaking blood everywhere. Thankfully, he survived that incident. I got loaded for 7 more years after that. See, because I don't know about you, but I just don't see the connection between my decision to get loaded and anything that happens as a result of me getting loaded. I don't see the connection. See, that him getting hit, that was... Dude, that's just a bad accident. It's just a stupid luck, right? Silly accident. I can't for a moment begin to see the truth about the decisions that I'm making and how that turns into harm to other people. And so it takes me to getting clean for 4 years before I'm ready to go and make amends to this guy. I've been through the steps 3 other times. I mean, I went through all 12 steps 3 other times by the time I get to this. It's an April date in 2009, I guess it was. And I make an appointment with him, and at the last minute he cancels the appointment, and I spend the next 5 or 6 years tracking him down on Facebook and email and everything. And you know, my sponsor had to point out that where the book says, you know, we made amends wherever possible, it doesn't say using all stalking technologies. And so it was suggested that I back off because it seemed apparent that through his lack of response to any of my inquiries, that he clearly had no intention of being in contact with me. And maybe I should respect that. And I couldn't see that. I just couldn't see it, man. I was so determined to do what I thought was the right thing and setting this thing straight, I could not see how it might be affecting him. And in fact, I continued to be quite visually impaired around that relationship for a number of years after that. I got to where I was clean 9 years, and I'm hitting this damn 9th step again. And I've just got this unresolved thing, and I got to do something with it, and I don't know what to do with it. And it occurs to me, you know what? He's not the only one I harmed. It occurs to me that, you know, that night, his parents got a phone call, and they were told that their son was being rushed to emergency surgery. They had to drive for 6 hours across the desert. This was before cell phones existed. They had no idea if they were going to find their son alive or dead when they got there. And I did that to them. And so I worked with my sponsor, and I wrote up the script, and I called to make an appointment to meet with them. And my friend's mother was a very protective kind of woman, and I was really hoping that his dad would answer the phone, but of course it was mom. And And I told her who it was, and of course there was a very pregnant pause, because why in the hell are you calling, right? I mean, we just got rid of your sister a few years ago, and now what do you want, you know? I said, you know, this is a very long overdue conversation. I'd like to make an appointment to come and speak with you and your husband. It's about some harms that I've done to your family, and I'd really like to find a way to try to set that right. And she told me that her husband was in some very late stage cancer treatment, that they had their hands full with all of that. They really did not have time to meet with me. And if I had something I wanted to say, could I please, please, just say it now? And there was a voice in my head saying, we don't phone these in, man. That's not how you do this. And then there was the other voice that said, unless to do so would harm them or others. And I thought, good God, have pity on this woman. Give it to her. And I told her, I said, what I told you, I knew what I did to them that night. And I knew that there was nothing I could do to take that away. But if there's anything I can do to try to restore that harm today, man, I'm here. I'm ready. I'm willing to do it. And you know what she said? She goes, oh, honey, everyone makes mistakes. Now, I forgot to tell you, there's a really important thing that was happening in the months that preceded that phone call. In the months that preceded that phone call, I just mysteriously all of a sudden started running into them. Like at the country cafe for breakfast, right? Their family would be having breakfast over here, and I'd be over here, and I'd see them, and I would just, man, my stomach's just in knots, right? Like I'm so ashamed of myself, and I can't even look at them, and what do you do with that, man? And my friend's brother ended up moving into a house just down the street from where my wife and I lived. And I'd drive by and I'd see him out in the thing. And I'm not waving. I put my head down. Don't want him to see who I am. And after that phone call, his brother came into the sandwich shop. My dad and I were there eating. And I got to hold my head up and I got to say hello to him. And I wasn't afraid anymore, man. I was free. There was one other thing that was said on that phone call that was really surprising. And it was, I shared with his mom, you know, about the work that I'm doing in institutions and trying to help other people who, you know, weren't as fortunate as I was and are paying a much heavier price. And I told her I had tried to make some amends with her son, and that I certainly understood if he never wanted to see me ever again. And she started laughing, and she goes, you know what, he's not mad at you. He was laughing about the whole thing when we got there. She says, but I can tell you why he's not returning your calls. See, he's remarried, and he and his new wife have a child. And I'm certain that it's out of respect for his own wife that he's not calling his ex-wife's brother. And I go, I'll be damned. And I'm free. Time is short, but I do want to say one other thing. This is something that I'm going through right now. You know, I kind of make light of it. I've learned that there's less likelihood of me getting hurt by this if I'm the one that puts it out there, right? So I told you the other night I got fired. And that doesn't feel good, okay? I got fired from a job that I've been miserable in. And I don't get some special privilege to live in a world that is populated by only reasonable people. There are unreasonable people in the world. There might be a few in this room. I'm one frequently. But the part that I read there about that we in offering forgiveness we often get it. I've been able to behave with dignity in the process of getting fired. I haven't had to tell anyone how I feel about them. And I don't get to behave like that on my own. I depend on you guys. The last bit I want to read from the book, and I'll be quiet. It says, in the process of our recovery, we are restored to sanity, and part of sanity is effectively relating to others. We less often view people as a threat to our security. Real security will replace the physical ache and mental confusion that we have experienced in the past. We approach those we have harmed with humility and patience. Many of our sincere well-wishers may be reluctant to accept our recovery as real. We must remember that the pain they have known. In time, many miracles will occur. Many of us who were separated from our families succeed in establishing relationships with them. Eventually, it becomes easier for them to accept the change in us. Clean time speaks for itself. Patience is an important part of our recovery. The unconditional love we experience will rejuvenate our will to live, and each positive move on our part will be matched by an unexpected opportunity. A lot of courage and faith goes into making an amend, and a lot of spiritual growth results. Thanks for letting me share.